Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer in our freelancing discussion that will actually be happening next hour. I'll give you a little heads up on that, but we are talking to a very specific freelancer right now. You know, after the flood, the literal flood in places like Haiti or Indonesia or the Rockaways, there's always another flood. It's a flood of volunteers armed with good intentions, some expertise, usually few supplies. These Samaritans rush into affected areas and help. But sometimes they don't help as much as they could, and sometimes they actually hurt. Radio producer and reporter Amy Costello took a look at the medical volunteers who arrived in Port-au-Prince, Haiti after the earthquake there. She has reported from Darfur all across Africa, and she started a very interesting media experiment called Tiny Spark. It looks at, quote, the business of doing good. Welcome back to WNYC, Amy.
Thanks so much.
So tell me about Tiny Spark. Give me the elevator pitch.
Sure. Tiny Spark is a podcast and radio program aimed at igniting debate about the business of doing good. And I think that we generally have ideas like when volunteers go into a crisis zone that they can only be doing good. But I think that lots of times there can be unintended consequences when you try to do good if it's not done well and thoughtfully. And as you said, I did report from Africa for many years. I saw many well-intentioned initiatives, many well-intentioned volunteers trying to do good there. And I have a very good understanding of how difficult that can actually be to achieve. So my program is aimed at kind of looking critically and closely at good ideas and seeing if they really are doing good.
Haiti. Let's talk about Haiti. Poorest country in our hemisphere. Horrible disaster. Americans, being the giving and caring people we are, we go in there. We fly there, sometimes organized, sometimes disorganized. Who are the volunteers? Where are they coming from?
Well, in the case of Haiti, there was so much loss of life that many American nurses and doctors and other medical personnel from the U.S. and really around the world descended on Haiti in the days and weeks following the earthquake, hoping to provide medical care that was much needed there. However, I did kind of a months-long investigation into this and found that many of the volunteers who went down there didn't actually have any experience working in crisis zones. Many had never worked outside of the United States, so they came directly from a hospital in New York City, went down to Haiti, and found that the medical circumstances there were obviously very different, and harm was caused along the way because they lacked training.
Well, let's hear a clip from one of your from your documentary. Here's one of those volunteers.
I really just wanted to stay at the airport and hide because there was so much chaos. And I've never been in a situation like that where I've, been in fear of my own life, actually. So I wasn't really aware of it until I actually was in that environment and how scary it actually really is.
Who was that?
So this is a volunteer couple from Indiana who had never been to Haiti before or never worked outside the U.S. They saw a telethon on the television of images of children who had lost limbs, who were losing their lives, and they felt compelled to go. So I profiled this couple. She's Jennifer Day. She's a registered nurse from Indiana. Her husband is an anesthesiologist. And they went down to Haiti and really encountered a lot of difficulties along the way. I mean, one of the most kind of frightening things to me that the anesthesiologist discovered was when he was doing surgery, he was trying to administer anesthetic drugs and found out that they weren't actually working, that the patients weren't becoming fully numb. So he figures that the medicine was either down there too long, there was no air conditioning down there.
Yes, stored in 100-degree temperature or somehow corrupted, yeah.
Exactly. And so there were lots of negative repercussions for patients because these volunteers weren't fully trained. Now, granted, this guy did try to find out what kind of medicine would be available before he got down there, but was really, when he got there, the reality was very different than what he found. This couple also describes no record keeping whatsoever. I mean, when you try to analyze a medical response in a place like Haiti, there's really no data generated about how patients did, how many died, how many procedures were appropriate or inappropriate. So there's a real lack of data about what was done to patients. And this is true in crisis zones around the world.
So a well-intentioned couple with some expertise in Indiana sees a telethon. It pulls on their sense of commitment, morality, whatever. Why do they make the decision, let's book our own flight? What goes on in their minds? Or maybe we should analyze the existing charitable organizations. Why don't they call Doctors Without Borders? Why don't they call the Red Cross? Or are organizations like those not set up to take the call from the person who wants to freelance right then and there?
Yeah, I mean, all those organizations were down there and did amazing work, and that needs to be said. There were a number of obviously highly qualified, very experienced medical people who were down there, agencies like Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, and those kinds of things. But there were a number of other people who just arrived literally alone. Many arrived without even water, food, a place to stay, and they thought that we'd just get down there, and as one guy said to me, just do surgery. And so it's very difficult to provide adequate medical care if you're not part of a comprehensive medical team. So actually, you're right. You should absolutely go down there with a group of people, with a team, so you can provide, you know, comprehensive care. But there was plenty of people who showed up literally, yeah, alone. They hopped on a flight with their backpack and not much else. And another, you know, really disturbing thing that I discovered was the lack of anesthesia, for instance. So lots of doctors arrived in Haiti without their own anesthesia, which they are required to bring in a crisis zone. And if they had training before they went, they would have known that. And so consequently, surgeries were done with either out anesthesia or they had to wait many days for anesthesia to arrive. And in the meantime, patients' health was declining seriously. Complications arose. Many people died as, you know, things that they should have brought along with them were being waited for. And so consequently, you know, this lack of training led to very difficult and negative consequences for many patients.
So, you know, you just said that as they're required to bring the anesthesia into a crisis zone, they should have known that. It implies that there is a best practices guidelines out there. But who is in possession of those guidelines? How is the message not getting out? I guess part of it, it's that Haiti on a good day is somewhat chaotic and after an earthquake is completely chaotic. But is there a failure in messaging that the well-intentioned couple in Indiana comes down and is surprised that it's not safe and they don't have potable water?
Yeah, I mean, there are guidelines and best practices available for anyone who wants to find them. They're freely available on the internet, for instance. There's a very good group called the Sphere Group that sets guidelines for working in humanitarian emergencies. And they, too, say all the things that you should bring, all the medical equipment you need to have, and a number of other things to provide adequate care to patients in these kinds of places. But you're right. You know, a lot of patients, a lot of volunteers are unaware of these things, as they were in the case of Haiti. And, you know, that's the thing. Unlike so many other kind of pressing global issues, this one is very solvable.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that somebody needs to take charge in the international medical community to start making these standards, to start having an accreditation process. I mean, right now they're calling for people to have to get accredited before they go down to these places, that they have a certain number of experience. But there's a great unwillingness on the part of the international community to take charge of this and to make somebody hold volunteers responsible before they go to a place like this.
It also seems to me, even if you don't go that far, there can be a message, almost a social norms message, that this just isn't done to go without the anesthesia and without the training. Maybe you don't need a formalized bureaucracy. I could see why that would be a turnoff. But the idea that, hey, let's get on a plane and just us being there is going to save lives, you know, maybe you could somehow correct people's impressions just by giving the message. I want to ask you about a specific procedure, and you talk about this in your documentary, and I think it's called External Fixators. Could you tell me about this and how it played out in Haiti?
Yeah, so external fixation is a process that many medical doctors in the U.S. and other parts of the developed world use. And it's basically when you break a bone. There used to be a day when you just got to slap a cast on it. These days, they use a series of rods and pins to place into the bone. They drill the screws into the bone and hold these rods in place while your leg heals. And it's a fairly routine procedure here, but certainly not one to be used when sanitation and other things like that can't be certain. So in Haiti, lots of doctors without experience working in developing nations went down there and started using a process for broken bones because that was the primary thing needed down there. Anybody who actually survived the quake likely had broken bones. So there was a huge need for orthopedic surgeons. So many orthopedic surgeons went down, put these, what they call, they're really called tinker toys. You mm-hmm. know, they're just these metal rods and pins into the leg and left. They're supposed to keep these.
Maybe gave him some advice. Swab it twice a day.
Yes, yeah. And come back to this clinic in 3 months and we'll
yeah.
take it out.
Yeah.
Patients went back to the clinic 3 months. There was no clinic there.
Yeah.
All these volunteers had left. I mean, this is all driven on a very short-term volunteer basis. So there's really no continuity in care. And so many patients were left languishing. And these these rods and these pins that were inserted into people's bones got infected. Terrible infections, which can lead eventually to amputation if not treated with a long-term course of antibiotics. So that's just one example of a treatment that was given that many people would say was completely inappropriate in a place like Haiti post-quake. And yet these surgeons, who were very well qualified in the U.S., didn't know any better. They didn't know that this would be an inappropriate intervention, that a much more simpler technique like cast or elevation or splint even until things, stabilize would be a much better approach.
And an established organization, a Doctors Without Borders, a Red Cross, American military would not be doing these sort of procedures.
Not in this environment. They are used frequently in war zones because soldiers can be treated very quickly with external fixation, but then they're swept off into a hospital with great care and completely sanitized.
Right. They get shipped to Landstuhl Medical Base in Germany, or at least, the MASH units are still there on the battlefield with U.S. surgeons to follow up. I want to make the transition to what we're seeing now in Sandy. It's very different because, the United States is unbelievably more advanced than Haiti, and there are procedures in place. But from your knowledge of being in war zones and being in Haiti and seeing the impetus to volunteer here and maybe how that dissipates after a time, do you see any similarities between post-Sandy and post the Haitian earthquake?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways that remains to be seen, is how strong will this volunteer effort remain when January rolls around, when the weather gets cold, when this is off the headlines, when people are still suffering a great deal. I think FEMA is only going to cover so much of the recovery, and I think that there's going to be a huge reliance on volunteer efforts and volunteer of goods to get these people and these communities back on their feet. But I think, it's just something to think about at this juncture when the volunteer spirit is so high as it is right now, to really think about how are we going to move forward? What kind of volunteer commitment are we making 2, 3, 4, 6 months down the road? When winter hits and maybe the enthusiasm that all the volunteers are feeling now kind of begins to dissipate. So I think that is something to think about. And I think that's something that can be planned for, but that certainly happened in Haiti, that there was a rush of volunteers in the first weeks and months after the crisis. But then many of these patients, and Doctors Without Borders said in their own report, thousands and thousands of post-operative patients were left alone with no care whatsoever because the volunteers had left. And so, there's questions that we could have about, do we have a responsibility to those that we're trying to help today, 6 months down the road from now?
In general, should we rethink volunteering? I mean, I was talking to people who are running efforts in some of the affected areas out on Long Island. We have T-shirts. We have canned goods. What we need is donations for the big unsexy expenses, like eventually a boiler. Well, what about that? I mean, should maybe volunteering be entirely rethought?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think that, so much of the volunteer effort in these recent days has been really wonderful to see. And I think that that's always a kind of a caution point that you have to have in any conversation when you're critiquing volunteers, is that you don't want to kind of quash that humanitarian impulse that resides in all of us. I think that that should be channeled really effectively and can do great good. But, I think that there is a big movement underway that cash is often more appropriate. So, to give cash for these big ticket items, as you're talking about, would certainly be very welcome by many of these groups, I'm sure.
All right. So that's the lesson to all the Brian Lehrer Show listeners. Right now, go into your calendars and in 6 months' time, enter in there, do some post-Sandy volunteering. And check out Tiny Spark, which is the startup and the website and the occasional podcast run by Amy Costello. She's a producer and a reporter. She explores the business of doing good. Thanks for having joined us here today, Amy.
Mike, it was my pleasure.